Day going so far?
Great.
Good. Oh, great. Excellent. Glad to hear it. Well, welcome to the session. We're going to focus on providing you with an introduction to workflow services. And specifically, we're going to focus on using Windows Server App Fabric to help us manage and configure those services. As you can see, my name is Matt Milner. I'm an instructor for Pluralsight. So I split my time between doing training with Pluralsight and doing consulting on workflow, WCF, all those connected system sorts of things. So we're going to focus on is just briefly, I want to kind of set some foundation and make sure everybody's on the same page in terms of workflow 4 and workflow services and what they do. We're not going to drill in and look deeply at the APIs, but conceptually it's important to understand that because it is built on when we start talking about the app fabric. How many people are using Workflow 4 today or Workflow Services? Two, three, okay. that'll be useful then. So we're going to talk about what Windows Server App Fabric is, and we're going to see how to get in and use it for configuring our services, managing and monitoring those services. One thing you'll notice we're not going to cover here is caching. So somewhere along in the beta cycle, Microsoft had App Fabric, the Server App Fabric, it's all about managing and configuring services, but they needed a ship vehicle for their distributed caching, the stuff that used to be called Velocity. And so that's also a piece of Windows Server App Fabric, this distributed in-memory caching. We're not really going to focus on that here. I'm going to spend my time focused on the service hosting and the service configuration pieces. So when we talk about App Fabric, it really is about services, and specifically WCF services. But I want to talk a little bit about Windows Workflow and Workflow Services as a particular type of service, because when we use Server App Fabric to manage these services, we get some additional features, we get some additional things that go along with that when we're working with Workflow Services. How many people would say they're really familiar or pretty familiar with WCF and writing services or consuming them? Okay, good portion of you. Great. So if we step back and look at another piece of the .NET framework, Windows Workflow Foundation, just like WCF provides us a framework for building or consuming services, Workflow Foundation provides us a piece of the framework for building declarative programs. And so we get the framework, we get a set of tools in terms of designers, in terms of support within Visual Studio and .NET for building these declarative program definitions, and it provides a runtime for executing these things. So we're going to build these applications or this program logic in a declarative fashion. So we can use the pretty designer, or we can actually do it in code, or if you really want to get serious, you can write XML by hand. And it's going to take that model then and provide us a runtime for that. Now when I think about workflow and declarative programming, I kind of think about where we've been with programming frameworks and kind of how we got here. How many of you have written some assembly language code? Okay, of those people with your hands up, how many of you had to do that for university and you don't do it anymore? Okay, somewhere along the line as I've been giving these talks, I was really shocked by how many people said, yeah, I've written some assembly. And I thought, wow, you know, it's 2010, 2011. That's more people than I thought. And then somebody clued me in along the way. No, I had to, right? It was part of my university. I didn't want to. It wasn't a job that I decided to go do. It was a requirement. But when we think about that, it's really about writing code at that low level. We're really targeting the machine. We're really thinking about, you know, what does the machine need? What does the computer need in terms of a program definition? And thankfully, right, for a lot of us, we've moved away from that. We've written in C-style languages where we got slightly more human language, right? Things like printf and methods and things that were, you know, a little bit higher level. But as we've kind of evolved in our development, we've moved on to higher level languages. We had object-oriented languages as we realized that, you know, if I think about things in terms of objects, in terms of the state and the behavior that they have, it's a little bit easier for me to reason over a problem, right? Construct a solution that makes sense to me as a programmer, but also makes sense to the machine or can be compiled down into something that makes sense to the machine. And then we moved on to .NET, right? Managed languages, or even Java, other languages with a runtime that we have. And again, the idea was, let's go up another level of abstraction. Just like these languages have helped me move a little farther away from the language of the machine, let's move another step up and stop worrying about things like allocating memory and deallocating memory and managing those objects. Right? Let's have a runtime with garbage collection that does that stuff for us. Let's have a runtime that provides us a set of features so that we don't have to write those things. Now, how many of you have written some C++? More than assembler. How many of you today, if you were going to go write a web application, would use C++? Not as many. How many of you, if you were just going to go write a Windows app, might choose C++? Oh, I thought I might get one. No, I got a maybe. It depends on the Windows app. It has a lot of user interface. Does that change your mind? All right. So what we get with these managed languages, one is we get this runtime, or we get a lot of features, but we've also gotten these libraries that come along with them and these frameworks. So if I'm going to build a web application, well, if I look at C++, it might be what I want if I were going to write an old style, ISAPI, or I was going to write something with no user interface and I want to generate HTML as strings. But we have in .NET these features and these pieces that go along with it, these libraries that make that easier. Right? User interface libraries and control libraries, and we've got libraries for things like WCF. And so as we've moved up, right, we've gotten additional things from these frameworks and from these libraries. We've been able to package those up. Declarative programming is kind of that next step. Just like the managed languages and the runtimes have enabled us to stop worrying about certain things like memory and object allocation, those sorts of things, the declarative programming model is going to provide us with a way to model out our application logic and a runtime that's going to, again, help us stop worrying about certain aspects of execution. Certain things like state management and tracking of our application logic or finding out things that are going, right? Giving us a set of features then that we can take advantage of while at the same time bringing up that abstraction level, right? Taking us up another level where we're going to model out our application and have the runtime interpret that, right? Bring our programming model up a level. So let me just give you a quick example of what I mean there. This is a simple activity or a simple workflow. I've got a set of activities over here in the toolbox. These are my building blocks, kind of the equivalent of controls that I might have in ASP.NET or WPF. These are my building blocks and part of the framework, part of the tooling. They're going to allow me to get certain things done. So I have controls that are very focused on control flow and language execution, like parallel and sequence and do whiles. But I also have controls that are focused on making WCF service calls. I have some things that are focused on transactions, managing low-level things. What I don't get in the framework, but I can add myself, are these custom controls. Just classes that I'm going to build, but now that I can compose into my application. So I can drag these things in here. And when we talk about the declarative nature of programming, what I really want to be able to do is set up something like this where I can simply lay out this execution and say, look, when I run this code, this activity that I've defined here, what I want you to do is come in, and here I want you to run two things in parallel. I don't want to have to write code to deal with spinning up the threads, right? I don't want to have to deal with iasync results and synchronizing. That's not really my business problem. That's just technical details. That's kind of the equivalent of allocating memory and things. Right? I just want to declare, go do these things in parallel. Because that's what my business requirements say. Right? Or that's what my functional requirements say, is I need to do this for performance. Because what I'm going to do inside here in parallel is I'm going to go out and get two chunks of data that I need to display on a page. And so I want those things to go out and execute at the same time so the data comes back quicker and I can display that page faster. And so by saying do this in parallel, each one of these is going to, in turn, spin up their own separate threads behind the scenes and do that stuff asynchronously. Now what I do to consume this is in my MVC controller here, I'm going to use this class called Workflow Invoker, and I'm going to simply say, go out and invoke that application logic that I just declared. Go run that model, that thing that I just described, for me. So I'm going to give it an instance of that. It was compiled into a class. I'll say, go invoke that. And you're going to give me then some results. I'm going to get output from that. And I'm going to simply pass those results up to my view here. So that declarative logic that I just laid out, while it looks different, it's got a designer behind it and some XML or some XAML behind that, it's just a program. It's just essentially a declarative function. I'm going to call it, I'm going to get some data back out of it, and then I'm done with it. So if we go start up my page, you can see that it was very quickly went out, got all this lovely employee data, and somewhere down here we'll switch over and we'll see all the task. There we go. All right, I've got a whole bunch of task information for those employees. So I was able to spin that up and have it go out and run those things asynchronously with very little coding and not having to worry about that. So the goal is to make those kind of complex control structures and those complex things much easier for us to put into our application logic and to build those applications where we can have these types of activities that we build. So this highlighted activity is just something that I built that goes out and queries an OData service. Or it goes out to essentially a web service and gets this data and brings it back. It's just a class, right, that I can now expose and share, and other people can have it in the toolbox and drag it in there. So that's kind of the basis for this model, this declarative programming model. And we can build all sorts of applications this way. Just basic functions like that, where it's simplifies my programming model, or more complex application logic, like a loan application, where I've got many different steps and interactions. And the framework's going to help me manage not only just that execution, but where am I in this process? Hey, well, I've submitted my application. I'm waiting for some sort of input or response, and it's going to keep track for me where I am in there. And so one type of application we might build with this is a service, a WCF service, and we're simply going to implement it as a workflow or as this declarative program. And it might be for the simple reason that we want to do something similar to what we had before, which is I want to expose out the service endpoint now, where you call my service, and as part of the execution, I need to go in and do some composition or some aggregation. So when you call my method and you want to get some data out of here, I might have to go to two or three back-end systems to actually get you that data. Some of it's coming from HR, some of it comes from the payroll system, right? Some of it's in a SQL database. I need to go out and get all of that and send it back to you. And so I can use the workflow then to coordinate that work, to call out to each of those systems, bring back their data, aggregate it back up, and send the result back. So what does this do? Well, it simplifies my programming model. It allows me to put this facade or this service out there for you to simplify your programming model. You want to call a service and get all this data, rather than forcing you to go, figure out and learn and know how to talk to all three of these systems, I could provide a simpler interface over that. It says you make one call, you'll get all that data back aggregated. Likewise, I may not want you talking to those systems, right? If that's my payroll or my HR system, I might want to gate that access. So I may want to use it as a control mechanism, right, where I surface up this service interface for you so that you don't have access to those back-end systems. And finally, what if it's not as simple as just, go do all three things at the same time and coalesce the data? What if I need to call the HR system, get a response back, use that response then to go call the payroll system? All right, so I've got now not just things in parallel, but I have this coordination of interactions that, again, I can model out very easily in my workflow, and you don't have to know all those interactions. Nobody has to go in and talk to all those systems in that particular order. So we get that declarative flow control. We also get this notion of state management. And I don't mean state management like we typically think of it. You know, a lot of people kind of get hung up when you talk about workflows and state. If you have a workflow, the typical example of I submit an expense report. When we talk about state management, it's not the expense report, right? It's not the application for credit. It's not that state that we typically have or want the workflow to manage. That you're going to put in your database like you do today, or you're going to store that. What the state management boils down to is, where am I in the process, right? And what are some of the state that's just really about this particular interaction, right? Essentially variables. What are the variables that I'm using that when this whole thing is over, I'm probably just going to throw away? But we also get, as part of Workflow Foundation, this notion of tracking. We have this runtime that executes our code, and part of that execution is that the runtime knows every single thing that's happening. So it knows when a certain chunk of code starts executing, when it finishes. It knows about all the data that's in scope, so we can ask it to track that information out. Right, so we can get history, we can get visibility into what's happening, either for business reasons, right, or for technical reasons and service level agreements. So it allows us to do some of these longer running processes where we need to manage state or coordinate these interactions. So if we want to have that declarative model, that workflow, and we want it to act and behave like a WCF service, we've got to integrate these two technologies. And so Microsoft provides this set of tools that come along with workflow and WCF to help us tie these together. We have a set of activities. So in our workflow, we can model out and say, hey, at this point, I'm going to receive a message using WCF. At this point in my process, I might need to go out and invoke a WCF service and pull some data back. So we have activities to wrap all that stuff up for us. We've also got a customized service host. With WCF, we have a service host. And when we set up a service host, it knows how to take SOAP messages or web service messages and dispatch them to some class, right, that we've written in the WCF model. Well, the workflow service host knows how to take that environment and customize it so that as messages come in, they get delivered into our workflow and they kick off those activities and those processing within our workflow. And finally, we need some form of message correlation. If you think about if I have an application and it's longer running, so you're going to submit an expense report and later a manager is going to come back and approve it. Right? Or we have this wizard, a credit application, where you're going to come in and every time you submit some data on a page, I need to come back and move the process forward. I need to touch that workflow. Well, we need a way then for me to correlate all those messages. Think about order processing. Right? If I go to Amazon or some other online retailer, right, as I'm going through the checkout process, they need to keep track of my shopping cart. Right? If you're checking out, they're keeping track of your shopping cart in your state. Right? When I come back in and hit that buy button, well, they better, in my purchase, only include my state, right? What was in my shopping cart. Otherwise, I'm going to end up buying whatever books or things you had in your shopping cart. And so when we have a process like that, when we're moving through the process and we're kind of touching it at different points, we need to make sure that when we go talk to the service, we're going to say, hey, I want to move to the next piece. I want to submit some data. We've got to be talking to the right instance, right? The one that's focused on that particular order or that user or that report or whatever it is. We need to make sure that all our subsequent messages go to that right instance. And so probably the most interesting way to do that is with content-based correlation, right, where we're going to use some content in the messages to relate these things together. So I have some simple application here where I'm going to start my logic in my workflow, and I'm going to create some task out there, and it has a particular identifier. Well, at some point, we're going to store that data. We're going to persist out that state and keep track of what is this thing that we're going to use to correlate messages. This is task ID 123. So at some point, I may call out to an external system, kick off some other work, and I'm going to then wait for responses to come back in. And this is where we need that correlation. We need to make sure that items that are in response to this task, 123, get routed to this instance of our workflow, our application, and all its related state. If it's for task 4, 5, 6, that should get routed to a different instance. And so as we receive that message, correlation is going to allow us then to map that onto the right instance, be able to go look up all the state for our application, and finish processing or continue processing that. Let me show you a couple examples here of what I mean with the workflow services and some of the pieces with the state management. So I've got just a simple web application here. I'm going to kind of run through the process so you can see what's happening, and then we'll come back and look how it's implemented. The process should look pretty familiar, as should the user interface, since it's just basic MVC. So I'm going to go register in this application. Now, with a typical MVC, what you're going to see is that when you register, you just get right in. Right? It's one of those set up to self-register, and as soon as you do, then you have access. But what typically happens if you go to a site and you want to register a new account? What do they typically do other than just let you write in? Yeah, they send you an email with a confirmation link. Right? Because they want to make sure that you can get the email, that you didn't mistype it, that you're not trying to spoof them with somebody else's email. They just want to do a little verification step. And so we're going to do that when you register here. I'm going to go out and create. And what I'm going to do, you can see here, is we created the user account in the membership store, but I didn't enable it. And then I'm going to actually go call a workflow service to kick off a validation process. And so I tell the user, hey, you know what? We've got your information. We sent you an email. Go watch your inbox. Now, I know you all use your C drive for email. Just have these things lying around indexed. But that's where my mail for my application is going to go. It's going to drop out there, and it says, hey, look, here's your verification email. Here's a link back to our site, and here's your code. So I'm going to come back into the site. There we go. This is what's your email. And there's my code. Now, why does it want my email? And not just the code. Yeah, that's my correlation, right? It needs to know, hey, who's trying to verify? Is it Matt? Is it somebody else? Right? Which instance of this whole process are we pointing to? What is it we're trying to validate here? So I'm going to hit save, and that's going to go enable my account, and now I should be able to log in, and it's got my username up there. So what's happening out there is I have this process that's going to execute, stop that, that defines my validation system, and it's really a pretty simple process. When you come in and you sign up in the system, that web service call is going to come out here and start validation. And what I'm going to do is generate a verification code, just some random code, some random number identifier. And I'm going to store it off in a variable. So you can see over here in the result, I'm storing it in this variable called validation code. And if I look down here, I can see there's my validation code. And then I'm going to send the email. And then I'm going to get down here, into a do while. And I'm essentially going to wait for that next call to submit that validation code. Now, in my example, it was really fast. Right? Email goes to my hard drive, it gets there really quickly. In the real world, right, emails take a little bit longer. They might be sending them out in a batch at night. You might not be sitting there in your Outlook or your mail program hitting your server. Could be a half an hour, could be 5 hours, could be a couple days before you actually go back and do this verification. Well, we're sitting here waiting. We certainly don't want to wait on a particular thread on the server. We'd kill our resources pretty quickly. And what's going to happen if this process dies? Well, We're going to lose our application logic here, all of our state, right? Including that code. Right? That code that I created, I just stored it in a variable. Right? I said, hey, look, when I generate this today, I'm going to store it in a variable. When you come back later today, tomorrow, next week, right, whenever that is, what I'm going to do when you submit that code is I'm going to check it. I'm going to take the code that you pass in, and I'm going to check it against that variable. So I need that variable to stick around. I need that to last. One of the things that workflow provides us is persistence of state. It provides us that state management. And so I don't have to manage this validation code. I just declare it as a variable, and I want workflow then to manage that for me. Without this, what would I do? Well, I'd have to go create a table in SQL, or at least add a column to a table for my validation code and my email. I'd need to go out and in that database, right? I'd have to, when the person came in and I generated the code, I'd have to save it to the database. Every time they came back to check, I'd have to load it back out, right? And so I'd be writing all this code to manage this little bit of state. And when you think about the validation code, what's going to happen to it when I activate their account? Just throw it away, right? It's not something I need to keep. It's not state I care about other than in this process. And so that's what we mean by state management is, gosh, you know, I just want to have a programming model that's as simple as it would be if everything stayed in memory and I just finished out the process. I want to declare a variable. I want to use the variable. And I want the runtime to take care of for me managing that state. Now, if we look at this process here, we've also got the correlation. Let me look at this one here. Whoops. We can see up here that one of the things I'm doing, let me expand that out a little bit, is I'm going to set up that correlation. I'm going to say, look, when I receive that message from the user, I'm going to pull out their email, and I'm going to use that as my key, as someone pointed out, as my correlation, and say, look, I'm going to use that email address, I'm going to kind of store that away, and indicate that that's a unique identifier for this instance. That's going to allow me to come back and find this particular instance with the email address. And so when we come down here later, and we're receiving data again, we're saying, look, I'm going to have another interaction here, then we also need to follow that correlation. And so we have that same key and this same variable, essentially a dictionary of these things. And I'm going in now to a different message to find the email address. So the email address doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be the same type that I'm sending in to each of these things. Somewhere in there, I've got to have that field match up. Right, can be called whatever it needs to be called. It can fall anywhere within the structure of that object or that parameter, but I can drill in here with this XPath and find that. Now, the good thing is you don't actually have to know the XPath. Right? It's going to give you a nice little drop-down like this, so you can just look at whatever the parameter is to your call and select that. So that's what's going to enable us to do these things. Now, because these are services, I can configure them using WCF behaviors. So I can come into the web directory where I'm hosting that service, right, and I can simply say, you know what, I have a connection string name, oops, and that's going to map up to some connection string up here. So that's the database I want to store these things in. And I've got some other options on there in terms of how I want to handle these things. So, you know, when they complete, don't want to keep any of that state. When they're encoded, right? So I can either say, look, the state for these things is going to be really large. I should compress them before sending to the database. Or they're small enough that compression is just going to add overhead. Right? And there's other behaviors that we can add in here. So workflow idle. This is kind of a unique thing with the workflow services, is that I can control and say, look, when a workflow gets to that point where all it's doing is waiting for other information, that means it's idle. It doesn't need a thread, it's not processing, it's just waiting for me to call back into it. With regular workflows, right, if I'm not using a service, then generally that means I can persist that state and I can unload it. Here I've got a little extra control and I can say, you know what? Chances are for this particular service that somebody's going to make that second call pretty quickly. And rather than take the hit of pushing that to the database, they call right back and I have to load it back up, rather than doing all this back and forth, just wait a little bit before you push everything to the database. And so I can set that up here and say, you know, wait a little bit because I want to improve the response time. I don't want to go back and forth to the database. Yes. Yep. Yeah. So you could drop it down and say, look, I do want you to persist right away. Yep. And there's also two different settings here. There's this notion of persist and unload. The persist is I want to save the state. I want to checkpoint it. Unload is I actually want to take this thing out of memory. So you kind of have these two pieces, like the gentleman was saying. I might really want to save the state right away and make sure I don't lose it. But I want to unload later. I want to keep it in memory so it can still respond quickly, right, if it comes back. So you have two different settings there. In 5 seconds, I'm going to make sure I save the state so I don't lose it, but I'll leave this thing in memory for up to a minute in case they call back. Right, so I've kind of covered both those bases. Yes. Yeah, so that's a good question. What happens if my system goes down? If it goes down after 5 seconds, I'm great. When the system comes back up, I can call in. It's stored in the database. It's going to use that email address and pull it back up. If it goes down before 5 seconds, I'm in trouble, right? So that's why you might want to do this and say, no, I'm not going to wait around to store this because, you know, who knows how much work I could lose if I leave it up for a minute. Yep. Uh-huh. No, so the XPath statement, the question was about that XPath statement and the correlation. This is it's a WCF operation, essentially. Right, I've modeled out with a receive activity here, getting a WCF operation. And what I've done is define the parameters of the content. And so you can kind of see here that I've got some parameter called initial request, and it has a type. And that's just a data contract. So inside this, right, we're still doing WCF, and so that guy is a data contract, which means, you know, at that level where it's actually going to do those queries, it has an XML info set and it can run an XPath over it. So even if I use binary encoding in WCF or I use JSON or something else, all right, by the time it gets here, it's going to be in an XML form that it can query over. Yeah. Yeah. So each of those things, if we step back, if I look at my contracts here, these things are just data contracts. That's what I'm passing around. That's what I'm using as parameters here. And if I go browse to this thing, oops, didn't type my time to unload correctly. That one's just a hint there. There we go. I'm just going to get a WSDL document. You can see I have a basic HTTP binding here. I've got two operations, start validation, submit validation code. To an outsider that looks at this metadata, this is just a WCF service. They don't know it's a workflow. They don't have to know it's a workflow. Right? There's nothing in the WSDL that says this is a workflow. Right? A Java client points to this. They get a client proxy, they can call it, right? Anybody can pull down this WSDL and have all that operation information and stuff surfaced up to them. Behind the scenes, right, they don't know how it's implemented. Just like if I point to a WSDL today, I don't know if they're using Java or if they're using WCF or old ASP.2, the ASMX style web services. I could probably poke around and kind of infer, but there's really nothing in there that tells me that because it's supposed to be cross-platform.
Uh-huh. When does it count to be idle? So for example, example from the workflow, send a message to another service, and I need to get an answer back.
Mm-hmm.
If that answer takes, for example, more time than the idle time,
yeah.
Going.
Yeah, that's a good question. So when does it actually consider it to be idle? And the example was, hey, if I call a web service, I'm making an outbound call and it takes a long time, at some point is there a time limit where it's going to consider it to be idle? And for that case, no, because those activities, it knows whether they do it synchronously or asynchronous, it knows, hey, this is executing. Right? It's using a thread, it's out there executing, maybe taking a long time, but it's still executing, and so it won't go idle. With the receive activity, right, it's a little bit different, and then it basically sets up and says, hey, I'm waiting for a particular operation to happen. But as soon as it kind of registers all that, it no longer needs a thread. It doesn't really need to process. And it's at that point that the workflow engine kind of looks and says, well, there's no activity actively processing anything right now. Now I consider it idle. Now, one of the things you'll notice, I had data contracts. I don't have any service contracts. Right, if we look at my receive activity here, I don't ever point to an I something service or any kind of interface. But what I'm doing is I have down here in the bottom, right, I'm going to specify the operation name. I'm going to specify a service contract name. Right, all the kind of things that you would do in WCF on the service contract and the operation contract. Those are things that you'd set up now on these activities. Right? I'm essentially modeling out this WCF operation so that between this, receive, right, where I'm saying here's the operation name and namespace, here's the incoming parameter. Between that and this related send reply, I've really defined an operation signature. I said, hey, here's an operation with a name and a contract namespace. Here's what it takes as inputs. With the send reply, right, we can look and see, in this case, it returns void. Right? We're really defining that operation signature, and so that WSDL that we were just browsing is driven from our model. Right? If we add new activities, we add new receives, the WSDL changes. Right? We've added to our service contract. Now, if we look at another example here, I'll just show you a similar example. I've got the same setup in here, the same error in here. Let me just browse to that one. So I've got a little expense service running in the web server. I've got two operations just like we had, so I can submit an expense report. I can get back a response. And this is a good example of where I'm not going to manage the state of the expense report in my workflow. It doesn't really make sense because that's my business data. I'm going to put that in a database. So let's put, oops. Can't type today. So we're getting done about the 30th. I know my dates are wrong technically, aren't they? They're too American. So I'm going to create this expense report. And so I've called that service. I've started an instance of it. There's a couple things going on. If I go to the manager's view, this now is just coming from the database. My expense report, all that information is stored off in the database in just my business tables. I've kind of normalized it out. And so that's what drives my interface here. But when I come back and say I want to approve or reject, what I really want to go do is go back to a workflow. So in my web application, right, when I submit the report, I'm kicking off this workflow service. Right, I'm saving the expense report out to the database, assigning some values there and giving some things back. And then again, I come down here and wait for the manager's response. So this is part of the goal of the declarative programming, these longer running programs, is again that I can manage the state here in terms of variables like maybe an email address that I want to use to send email. Right. So as we get down here, I'm going to send an email and say whether this was approved or rejected. Right. And if we look at the properties for that, we can see that I'm going to use some data that I got in that initial submission. I'm going to look into the email address that was in there and grab that out. I kind of cheated and actually did store the expense report, but right. So we're going to receive that, right, update our database, and then we'll send out our mail to let them know whether it succeeded or failed. And so here, if we go look at our, let's see if I can get it to show up here. If we go look at the link, you're going to see that as we go approve this thing in my web app, what I'm passing is, what's the ID for the report? Why do I need that? That's my correlation. In the code behind for this page, I'm going to call that manager method. I'm going to say, here's my response, approve or reject. And here's the report ID, so you can correlate back to that correct instance. Okay. So this is the piece that we'll use coming up. We'll use this expense reporting example as we start looking then at Server App Fabric. So before I switch gears a little bit and start talking more about Server App Fabric and what it provides, are there questions about the workflow services from what we covered here, or workflow in general?
So what's the main difference between running them as a workflow service and just running them within your application with a runtime?
Yep, that's a great question. What's the difference then between that first example where I just invoked it as a method and doing it as a service? Right. There's two. One is, when I did the invoke as a method, that was a particular use case of I had logic that was going to kind of run from start to finish and be done. And that works really well just calling it from my application. With a workflow service, it really lends itself to this kind of model of, you know what, I might have multiple interactions. It's more of a stateful service and longer running. And I can't do that as easily within my code. It's actually much easier to host it as a service. The other thing is that I kind of touched on workflow providing things like the runtime and the state management for services. But the opposite is true in that now my workflow is accessible outside of my application, right? I can have that Java client come in and be the one to call one of those methods, or I can have some other client now be able to interact with my workflow. So it kind of pulls that thing out of my application and extends the reach of it. Yeah, so good question. Do I need any kind of special setup for the SQL server? If we go out here, I've got the database that I was just using, this persistence database, and it's got a set of tables out there. This is probably empty at this point. Yeah, but it's got all these fields. In the .NET Framework directory, in the install directory, there's a SQL directory, and then you'll have a language-specific directory there, and you'll find all these SQL scripts. These are the two right here that provide all that setup. So rather than give you a database, they give you the SQL scripts, and you can run it into a separate standalone database, or you can run it into your existing database and have those things sit right alongside your pieces. So all the schema, all the tables and views get installed by one, all the stored procedures and everything else get installed by the other script. And that also allows you to run those scripts into multiple databases. Right? So some workflows, some things I'm hosting, I'm going to point them over here. Other things that I'm hosting, I need to separate that state off for legal reasons or business reasons that I can't have those things co-located in the same database. Or it may just be for scale as well. All right, so let's shift gears a little bit. So we've got services. And we have kind of two flavors. We've got just regular old WCF services where we're writing lots of code. We have service contracts and service hosts and all that. And then we have our workflow services, primarily for those stateful, longer running kinds of interactions where we want to manage them a little bit differently. And now we've got Windows Server App Fabric. And the whole idea behind this is that today, whether it's a WCF code service or a workflow service, most people are hosting those today in IIS or in taking advantage of the Windows Process Activation Service. Right. And the IIS tooling is great, but it was geared towards web applications like ASP.NET and those sorts of things. So there's not a lot of tools in there specifically for service configuration or service management. We've got all those great little IIS7, all the different features, lots of ASP.NET configuration serviced up in there, like authorization and configuration of the connection strings and stuff. But I've also got IIS configuration in there for SSL certs and what kind of authentication do I need. But I don't really have any WCF things in there. And so really this server app fabric, that's one of the things it tries to address, is let's provide some tooling for managing those applications. Right? And it's really all about service management. Right? I need to configure my services, behaviors, and bindings. I need to monitor those things. Right? I want some sort of visibility into errors that are happening, problems that are going on. Right? And with these workflow services, I also need another level of management. Right? Because they, since they're longer running, right, we've got potential for different kinds of problems. Well, the regular WCF service is, if it has an exception, right, and we throw a fault, well, it's not great, but we can generally call back into the service. With a workflow service, though, remember we're managing state, and we've got these longer running processes, so it makes it a little more complicated. If I get halfway through that overall process and I throw a fault or an exception, it might not be okay to just have everything go away and have to restart. Right? So we have some additional management for that. Now the tools, as we'll see, are both IIS Manager or GUI-based, but also some PowerShell tools as well. So when you think about App Fabric, right, it's really just an extension to the application server role on Server 2008. You know, in Server 2008, you have this notion of roles where you set up a server and you can go in and say, I want to add the file server role. And it configures all the stuff you need to do file sharing. Right? Or I want this to be an Active Directory role. Right? It's going to go out and set up all the Active Directory stuff. Well, the App Server role today enables things like IIS. It enables the core WCF pieces and things like NetTCP, listeners in IIS, all that stuff. And Server App Fabric really is just an extension of that. In fact, potentially in whatever the next release of Windows Server is, right, when you go in and say, I want this to be an application server, right, these features that we're going to look at are just going to be checkboxes under there where you'd say, yes, I want that. That's just part of Windows. That also means it's licensed as part of your Windows license, right? So there's no additional cost for this. The goal was to leverage those existing tools. You know, rather than creating some new management console, some new API and a whole different model, they said, we're going to leverage IIS because that's what people use today, and we're going to leverage PowerShell because that's what people are using in a kind of a scripted or interactive non-GUI mode. All of this is focused on WCF and workflow. Right? How do I configure those? How do I manage those? It's going to leverage some features of .NET 4, specifically some of the WCF 4 configuration improvements, as we'll see. And the key thing to remember that usually trips people up is Windows Server App Fabric is not a new host for your services. Right? There's no new executable that hosts your services or does anything like that. You're still hosting an IIS. What Server App Fabric provides is just additional tooling. Right? It provides tooling around the UI, the experience of managing it, and some background services that are going to augment, right, or support IIS as the host. The IIS team will really tell you that. They want to make sure you know that the W3 worker process is still the king for that. Right? And so what we have is kind of this existing investment. We have IIS and Windows. We have the .NET framework already. And they provide functionality. Right? All the stuff I was just showing you didn't leverage App Fabric at all. Right? And yet, in the .NET framework, in workflow and in WCF, I get the state management with the SQL provider that we saw. I get all sorts of diagnostic information through tracking and tracing, right, that I can collect out. I've got all of those features in the framework. And what App Fabric does is just add to that. Right? And so it sets up, when you install it, when you configure it, it's going to create two databases for you. One is that same persistence database we just looked at, right, those SQL scripts. But it's going to add some additional tables and stored procedures to that that it leverages to help us manage our workflow instances. It's also going to create a monitoring database. One of the things about the monitoring box down here in the .NET framework level is that WCF and workflow have really rich data that you can get out of them. But today in .NET 4, they write all that data to Enterprise Trace for Windows. How many people are familiar with Enterprise Trace for Windows? I think I saw one, maybe two hands, right? Exactly the problem. It's great. It's used by Windows, by low-level kernel drivers. It's super fast. But not many .NET developers know about it. And frankly, it's not that easy to go, you know, hook up and consume it. And it's all kind of in memory. Right? If somebody's not listening, isn't pulling that data from where these systems are writing it, it just disappears. Right? And so one of the big things that AppFabric gives you is it listens. Right? It listens and it stores that information in a SQL database for you. And it does that by using one of these services, this event collection service. Right? Its whole purpose in life is run, listen for all that monitoring data, put it in the monitoring database. So it simply helps us by collecting the data that we want and storing it so we can come back and look at it later. The workflow management service we'll touch on also runs, and its job is to help us with that kind of extended management we need for those workflow instances. When they fail, already some questions about, you know, what happens if the process goes down, how does that thing get restarted? That's its job. And finally, then we've got this set of tools. And primarily when you interact with AppFabric, these are the things you're going to see, right? The UI that you're going to use and the tools that you're going to use in there. All right. And of course, you've got to have the System Center Operations Manager over there. All of it plugs in, and there's events and those sorts of things. Now, how many of you have done some WCF configuration? It was a lot of people. I know you're never supposed to put a slide up where people can't read it, but don't feel bad in the back because I don't think anybody in the front can read it either. This is a pretty simple WCF configuration file. We have a couple of endpoints. Right? There's a lot of configuration on there. Now, what would happen if you gave this or some piece of this to your operations person and said, hey, can you go do this? Can you apply this in production? Right? They love that. They love XML, right? You're going to give them a little snippet, and you're going to say, okay, I want you to put it right here in the file, right? Or go find this XML element and change it. They love those kind of directions. Right? So, you know, if you can't read it, you know, if they can't understand it, how are they going to, you know, supposed to go in and edit this stuff and work with this stuff? And so that's one of the goals with these tools is let's simplify that. Right. WCF did some work in .NET 4 to make the XML simpler, which meant a lot of it could just go away, which is great if you're a developer and is going to really help us here, but could cause additional problems when you say, hey, go change this element, and the admin looks and it's not there, right? Or they can't find that particular configuration. And so the idea is let's simplify that piece of configuring, but also let's see if we can simplify the deployment so your app maybe doesn't need as much configuration in it. Right. So I'm going to take my service here. Oops, that's not the one. And if we look at the web config that I was using, you can see I'd plugged in all these different pieces, right? So this is my expense reporting service. I wanted to make sure when I browsed I could get metadata. I wanted to set up the persistent store so I could save state. And my idle setup there. I also had this little setup that said, hey, if in this workflow service some exception bubbles up, here's how I want you to handle that. In this case, I said, you know what, I just want you to abandon any changes in memory, and I want you to mark it as suspended. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all that out. In fact, we can get rid of that connection string for our persistent store as well. I'm going to leave my entity framework in there. And I'm going to change this expense reporting here. I say, don't stop using the ASP.NET server. Use the IIS web server. So we'll just double check this. Now, Before I do that, so we've got a good number of people in here that do WCF. I have nothing in my config file for my service. I just took away all my behaviors, everything else. What should happen if I go browse to this demo, this service now? Hey, I got a document. I got a help document. Notice that I'm browsing now, no port number. I'm browsing out to IIS. I'm in a particular directory now, expense reporting. And I don't have any behaviors, but I'm still getting metadata. I've got my service out there now getting metadata that it picked up just by me putting it out into IIS. So what's going on there? If we come look, when you install Windows Server App Fabric, you're going to get some additional pieces here in your dialog. You're going to get this App Fabric set of modules or features in here that we can interact with. And I'm going to have over here in the action pane, right, the ability to go in. It says, hey, you want to manage your WCF services. So if we look up here, I've got the site selected. And I can either come over here to the actions pane and configure, or I can right click and configure this, and I can say, hey, I want to configure my services, and it's going to pop up this little dialog. And one thing you'll note right here is that it's got this little box check that says, hey, enable metadata over HTTP. Now I can see up at the top that these settings apply to the server. What happens with just regular old .NET config when we put it in higher level config files? Cascades down, right? So it cascades down from the server level here to the site level to our application level. So we now have a setting that's up at the machine level. As soon as I push my code over into IIS, all that stuff cascades down. So I got metadata for free, basically. Right? Metadata was enabled on the server. I didn't have to do it in my config file for my service. Let's look at what else is in here. Oh, we've got persistence. We can kind of look over here and see that we have this persistence store. We've got a named connection string. That named connection string lives up at the machine level, right? The higher level web config up at the machine level. So that enables a couple things. One, hey, when I moved into IIS, even though I don't have any config in my service, I'm automatically going to pick up persistence as well. All my services are going to inherit this. They're going to be able to have persistence without me having to configure it in the app. And right, at whatever level I do, I'm just using named connection strings from the web config on the machine. So I never have to have a connection string in my service that points to a particular server or particular database. Right. I can push that stuff up to a higher level config on the machine and in the environment where it makes sense. So if I come down to the site, I can do the same thing here, right, and configure. And we'll see that it looks pretty much the same. Really, that's a little bit tricky. The only thing you're going to see is up here at the top, a little context that, oh, you're doing this for the site. So if I happen to go in here, and let's uncheck the metadata here, and even on the persistence, let's say none, and I hit apply, one of the things it's going to warn me about is it's going to say, hey, all the services might recycle if you do this. That's a little clue for us, because we know what happens in ASP.NET. That what's happening is we're messing with config. So if I go here to this root of my default website, you can see that what happened is when I went in and checked those boxes and turned on or off those behaviors, it translated that into the appropriate WCF config for me. So it says HTTP GET enabled is false, and now it's removing the SQL workflow instance store. It's basically saying, look, the behavior was applied at a top level, right? It was all set up for you, but if you don't want it, then we're going to remove it here. Now, does everybody kind of understand this unnamed behavior? This is a WCF4 feature. This is part of their configuration simplification. And what this says is any service in this scope, right, which in this case is the site, any service that doesn't specifically apply a service behavior is going to pick up this one. So it used to be we'd have to do something like this. Service name equals foo, and then we'd say behavior configuration equals something like that. And we put our endpoints and all that good stuff in here. Right? It used to be required that if you wanted to associate some behavior with a service, you had to call it out. You had to say, look, this is the name of the behavior that I want to apply. And what they did in WCF4 is they said, well, look, you can still do that, but if you leave that off, essentially your behavior configuration is blank, and we now have a behavior with a name of blank. They match. They match on nothing. And so if you didn't specify one, that's what you get. So it's this combination of just regular .NET config cascading and this new feature in WCF4 that allows us to apply these behaviors to any service, right, that allows us to apply now these WCF behaviors across the board. Right? So anything under the site that hasn't specified a behavior is automatically going to get these. I won't change that. So I could come down as well if I go, at the application level, I have the same thing. So essentially, as we get down in these different levels, it's all about the scope. And when I say scope, it really means which web config is it going to edit, right? Yes, sir?
Does that mean that I have to use .NET 4 to use .NET 5?
Yes, because the config things are only going to work with .NET 4. Yeah. Now, most of your WCF services, if they're written in 3.3.5, are going to run under 4 fine. So we get a slightly different one here when we're at the application. We have some additional things, but So if we go in, we can see right now our metadata, it's picking it up. All right, the UI is nice. It's going to show us that at a higher level, metadata has been disabled. Right, so I'll go ahead and enable it here. And what that'll do if we go back in here is it's simply going to override. It's going to say, look, here's a behavior. All right. Has the service metadata, now it's enabled for your service. So the scope at which we apply these things is really about which web config are we changing. So let's change one more thing in here. Those are all pretty simple changes. But let's go in here and let's look at monitoring. So monitoring is going to set up a couple things. One is, at the very top here, we're going to say, I want to write events to the database. Right? I want to use that monitoring store that AppFabric provides. And again, I have a named connection string. But I also just have this little level here. And right now, it says health monitoring. I'm going to jack that way up to troubleshooting. I say, look, I'm having problems with this app. I need to collect more information. If we go apply that, now we just got a little bit more stuff enabled here, right? Now we have this new behavior, this tracking behavior for workflow that says, yeah, track this, points out to this profile called troubleshooting that defines what to collect. But we also had stuff now under service model diagnostics. It's got this end-to-end tracing thing in here. We've got this Microsoft application server monitoring, right? That one change in the UI ended up making 3-4 different configuration changes in here. So if we step back to that nice slide with all the XML on it, right, and your thoughts about how do I tell my admin to go change these things, right, the goal is that you don't have to. Right? We take a step up and say, look, send them a Word doc with a couple screenshots, or an email that says, right-click here, go to this monitoring tab, and slide this slider to this setting. Right? And then, boom, all the stuff that needs to happen applies then on the back end. But the simple idea is that those changes we make in the UI are 98% of the time simply changing our web config. There's a couple related to auto start that are actually changing some of the IIS config, the application host config. Yes, sir.
Just a minor question about the levels of configuration. Those configuration changes you did right now are for the nameless behaviors. So are you able to define configuration on SVC level so that you can actually create native behaviors that way?
Yeah, so the question was, can I go define some of that configuration, not in that anonymous or unnamed behavior at the virtual directory level, but could I do it at a service level? And the answer is kind of yes and no. So if I go in to the app, I'll see one of the things I can do with the app fabric piece is list all the services. And again, this is kind of scope specific. And so here, actually over on the right, I can configure or I can double click. Now I get specific settings for that service. But what you'll see is, by default, this is going to use that same unnamed behavior. When I show you PowerShell in a second, though, I'll show you, you actually can use the named behaviors like before. And when you make changes to a specific service like that, it'll find the right behavior and change them. But it's not the default, and so there are some places where if you're not on the right scope, then it doesn't apply correctly, and you kind of get things in the wrong spot. So we've seen configuration, right? That's one goal, was to simplify the configuration of our services. But the other is we want to monitor these things. We talk about this monitoring store we have over here. We don't want to have to always go write, you know, SQL queries and figure it out. We want to have a dashboard that lets us know at a glance how our service is doing. Right? Are they throwing a lot of exceptions? Do I have a lot of things that are failing? Do I have a lot of those workflows that are blowing up and getting stuck? Right? And so the dashboard allows us to go in and collect some of that information from the monitoring store and from the persistent store, right, where we have those saved workflow instances. We've also got some interesting data there. And the other, as I mentioned, is this workflow instance management, where we want to go in and when we have workflows that maybe have problems, right, we want to be able to detect those, but we also want to be able to do something about it. Let's say we have a workflow that calls out to a database or calls out to an external web service. And we can see that maybe 10 or 15 of those things are faulted, right? They threw an exception because the network was down or the data source was down. And so they've now faulted and they're stuck. Well, we want to be able to come back in once the problem's fixed and have those things resume. So we can do that with the workflow instance management. The other thing I'll just mention is I talked about that workflow management service. Its job is to do some of that for us automatically. So if you think about having three web servers, you can point them all to the same databases, right? The same monitoring databases, the same persistence databases. This is going to allow you to do load balancing, right? Failover, all the kind of stuff you want to do with web services and web-based applications. And so what happens is that workflow management service is running on each of those boxes. Right? And it's monitoring that persistence store. And so if we have an instance maybe that started on a server, right, and was running and actually could still be running if the server hadn't exploded, right, what will happen is that workflow management service is going to pick that up from the database. It's going to say, hey, there was a service that was running. I haven't heard from it in a while. Right? And so what I'm going to do is pick that up, and I'll execute it over here. So we just have this background service that's fairly straightforward. Its job is to monitor that persistent store, find these services that maybe had some problem in the middle and for some reason aren't running, aren't using up resources when they should be, and it'll pick it up and start it on another server. Now we've been looking at the GUI. I'll also just quick show you some PowerShell so that in addition to, you know, point click, right click sort of model, you can use a scripted environment or you can use a command shell interactively to work with these App Fabric components. So what I want to do is let's go into our service here. I'm going to do a couple things. One is, I'm going to break my application. All right, so I'm going to pretend that my mail server is down. And the other is, I want to make sure for my application, I want to look at my configuration of WCF. Let's look at our persistence. Take that. So we'll take the default store, right? So I don't have to know the connection string here. Then we can see that I can, you know, set up all those same things that I was doing before on the behavior. But I'm also going to come in and say, you know what? There's that unload time. Let's change that to 30 seconds. And I'm going to change that persist to 5. Right? I want to make sure that 5 seconds after something happens, I want to make sure I check my state. I want to persist that so I can recover. And finally, I'm going to tell it if there's some sort of exception, right? If the application blows up, I want you to do 2 things. I want you to take any in-memory changes, right? Anything that's changed in memory since it was last persisted, just throw it away. Right? Don't corrupt my data store with that. There's clearly a problem. Just throw it all away. Right? And I want you to go in and mark that workflow as suspended. Right? I don't want it to be able to continue. I don't want somebody to be able to call into it again because there's clearly a problem. In our case, a system is down. It can't talk to that system. So I want to force somebody to come in and resume that. Now let me do one other thing here because I think, no, that's on there. So I have 2 protocols enabled here, the HTTP and net named pipes. The net named pipes is enabled so that I can, so that some of our control works. Let me make sure that's there. And since I'm going to run PowerShell anyway, we'll start firing that up. So there's, for some reason, PowerShell's.
Can you also export this configuration for
deployment? Good question. So can you export the configuration? The configuration is all in the web configs and in the IIS, so you can in terms of just taking the application and moving it. But you can also export the application, and that's just part of IS7 and part of the web deploy. And so this composes really nicely with all the IIS tools that have been coming out in terms of deployment and web farm management. All right, eventually PowerShell is going to start. Okay, so I've got my service now. Let's go in and, you can refresh. Let's go in and run our app. Oh, wrong app. Let's go run the web app. What we'll do is we'll fire up a couple of these expense reports. And so we'll put, won't worry about making them too different. Oh, that helps. So I changed my endpoint. Remember, I moved my service over into IIS. I need to change my client so it's actually now pointing at IIS. Ooh, that didn't work well. So we'll get back here, try that again. So what I want to do is I'm going to start a bunch of these, and then as I go in and try and approve or deny them, right, what the workflow is going to try and do is it's going to try and, it's going to make me do this, isn't it? I always forget that part. It's going to try and send those emails. Let's just create a couple more. And then if we go over here to the manager role, we can see there's all these different pieces over here. Right. So I'm going to try and approve. Oops. All right. I got an error. Let me go over here and deny. Right, you got errors. I could do a better job of catching these, by the way, and sending them back. So let's go into App Fabric now. I've got all these problems. Let's go into the dashboard. We can see I've got these suspended instances. I've got four. So this dashboard, if I just collapse these things up, it has three different panes. It has persisted workflow instances. That's all coming from the state database. It shows us what are all the workflows we know of in the state database and what state are they in. Are they just idle, waiting for input? Or are they in some sort of a suspended state, or are they actively processing? We have the WCF call history, which works for any kind of service. Right? And that's going to give us just some details on completed calls. We've got exceptions. We can go and drill in. Each of these is just a link to a report or a query to go and show us those different items there. So I can see I've got some submit report calls and some submit manager response calls. And then the bottom is going to be workflow instance tracking. Right? It's going to show me, show me data from the monitoring store about things that have happened. Right? And whereas the persistent stuff will go away generally when the workflows are done, the tracking will stick around. Right? That's my monitoring data to find out what happened there. So I'm going to click this link and go find these suspended items. And I can see if I look, I've got an error. And it's going to tell me, oh, the host wasn't specified. Right? So I've drilled down in now. I've found that the error is related to my SMTP. So I'm going to come back over to the right web config here. And I'm going to fix that. It's probably not going to be that easy for you to fix your problem in production. But, and so if we look, though, what happened was these things now are suspended. Right? I'm not going to be able to call them. If I go back and try and call this service from my web app, I'll get another exception. And so I need to be able to come in and administratively, maybe pick a couple of these, and say, hey, will you go please resume those? And it'll take a little while, and you can see that what happens, I have this pending command. This is the other function of that workflow management service that's running, which is take this command and queue it up in those extra database tables so that that workflow service can pick them up and process them. It means that I don't overload that service. It means that there's built-in retry of these commands and other things so that that service can go out then and resume these. So now if I refresh and look for suspended instances, I can see those two are gone. Now just real quick, I'll show you the PowerShell. So I'm going to import a module called Application Server. And what that's going to do is give me a bunch of commands. So I'm going to get all the commands that that added, and you'll see if you look at them that I have things related to instance stores, monitoring, all those things that we were looking at in the user interface are commands that I can use either from the command line here interactively or build into a script. And so one of the things I might want to do is go out and get some particular instances. So if I start looking, PowerShell's nice, it starts everything I'm going to use to get things as Git. So maybe I want to go get AS App Service instances. Now I've got a number of those out there. So I can see that I've got some status running idle. That's that one that's not a problem. I've also got some other ones up here. Those are the two that aren't there. And then I have these items that are suspended. So if we look at the help for that thing, we can see it has a lot of different parameters. But one of the things I can look at is the condition that's out there, and I can also look at the status that's out there as well, and I can look for those particular items. So if I do suspended, it's going to give me back these objects, just the ones that are suspended. And I know if I go look at my commands here, right, that I can suspend instances, but I can also resume instances. So what I'm going to do is, down to the end here, so I'm going to get the suspended ones, and I'm going to pipe that to resume AS app service instance. And just like I could do in the dialog, I can use PowerShell now, and I've gone out and resumed those items that were out there. Right. So now I should be able to come back here and see if my, oh, there we go. Approve a couple, deny a couple. Right. And now, of course, my mailbox is filling up with all the replies there. Right. So the monitoring helps us go and find those problems, right, figure out where the errors are. The actions on there allow us to manage those workflow instances where we can suspend them, we can find those instances. We could also go out and delete those things from the instant store if they're causing problems for us out there in the system. So those are really the goals, right? Simplify configuration, simplify the management and monitoring of these things using App Fabric. All right, and I know I'm just over time, so I'm going to stop there, but any questions that anybody has? Can you connect it to Windows Azure? The tooling, no. Right, so you can't connect up to the Windows Azure or the Azure App Fabric. You can on Server 2008 R2 with the auto start capability they added. You could host a service in Windows Server App Fabric and expose it on the service bus that's part of Windows Azure App Fabric. All right, so that you can kind of connect them that way, but this is all kind of local execution.
Because there's no similar way of looking at status of workflows like this tool does.
Right. Yeah, and the workflows aren't really out there yet in Azure. Yep. Tool to manage the workflows in terms of? Yeah, so is there a tool to help a business user manage the workflows? Not really. The framework, that designer you saw in Visual Studio, you can pick that up and rehost it in your own app in about 30 minutes. They made it really, really easy to do that. So you can make it pretty easy for somebody to edit a workflow or look at those workflow definitions. And you can also use that and layer this monitoring data on top of it to kind of show a visual path of this is how it went. They didn't get that into the product, but I know that's a big ask from people is, hey, could you just show me a visualization of what happened in there? Yeah. All right. Yes. Yeah. So with the correlation, could I have, you know, maybe email is for one interaction, but later on I've got some other identifier that I want to use to correlate? Absolutely. And you can use more than one as well. Right? So it might be customer ID plus order ID is what makes this unique. Right? It's not just one particular field. You can have a combination of things that act as your correlation key.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yes. Yeah, there's an activity called a pick activity. And essentially what that does is says, look, I'm going to pick one of these things. And it becomes kind of a race. It has a trigger and you say, one trigger is that they responded. And the other trigger is a timer or a delay. Yeah, when it's persistent in the database, it actually stores that timer information, and it knows, hey, you know what? The time's expired. I'm going to load this back up into memory, and we're going to do whatever was supposed to happen when that timer expired. Yep. I'm going to step off the stage and make room for the next presenter and let you guys get your snacks, but I will stick around if you've got any questions. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Uh-huh. Custom activities.
Yep.
You also used to have a code activity. That's gone now, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, because... Yeah,